I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope, gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Ken Jacobs, born in Orono, Maine. Did I pronounce that right, Ken? Orono, Maine. Lived in and about Washington, D.C., has lived for more than 30 years, where he spends his days when not making poems, writing and breaking software, whose book Sooner, Phylum 2009, was composed with the assistance of Custom Software, and whose Relegy, or maybe Re-Elegy, which do you prefer?
Relegy.
Relegy, developed in Processing and ported to Processing.js, which is a visual programming language, is the first compositional application that he has built for use by others. And by Mark Nowak, social critic, poet, labor activist, and as a poet whose writings include the New York Times Editor's Choice Shut Up, Shut Down, with an afterword by Amiri Baraka, and the acclaimed book on coal mining disasters in the U.S. and China, Coal Mountain Elementary, 2009, a book Howard Zinn called A Stunning Educational Tool. Founder, not Zinn, but Nowak, founder of the Union of Radical Workers and Writers, whose verse play on Ronald Reagan's firing of Patco air traffic controllers is called Capitalization. And by Ron Silliman, who has written and edited more than 30 books, including The Alphabet, a 1,000-plus-page poem in 26 parts, each titled after the letter of that aforementioned writing system composed and published between 1979 and 2004, who is now engaged in another big project called Universe, whose essays, especially Disappearance of the Word, Appearance of the World, and The New Sentence, have been widely republished and discussed and taught, even by yours truly, and whose eponymous blog has been visited a number of times well into the millions, and who, after moving from the Bay Area to Philly in 1995, has been a consistent member of the writing community here at the Writer's House. Ken, welcome to the Writer's House, I think, for the first time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here, and thanks for coming from D.C. And we promised more Philly-D.C. connections here, and we're still working on it, so we're glad that you're, at least today, representing the D.C. scene. Mark, welcome back to the Writer's House.
Thank you.
And you're going to give a reading after this recording, and we'll put that up on your Penn Sound page, and I'm looking forward to that. And Ron, thrilled you're here. Back again.
Always glad to be here, Al.
And we are looking forward to a course that you're teaching to undergraduates here at the University of Pennsylvania at the Writer's House. Fantastic. All right, today we're gathered here to talk about a book by Charles Alexander called Near or Random Acts, which is an acronymic reworking of the name of the poet's daughter, Nora. It was published in 2004 by Singing Horse Press, the press founded by Gil Ott. The book honors both the poet's daughters, Kate and Nora, but we're focusing on the first of two parts of the book, 77-line poems written for Nora. He was writing these poems throughout 2001, and we planned a celebration of Gil Ott here at the Writer's House for October 27th of that year. Charles gave a reading 2 days earlier and read most of the recently written sections of the poem, the project having been interrupted by non-poetic doings and distractions during and after the September 11th attacks. A second set of recordings of this poem, all 70 of the Nora poems, was made for Penn Sound in the summer of 2012. So we're going to discuss sections 56 through 66 inclusive. The recordings we'll hear include 56 and 57 as read in 2012, then 58 as it was introduced and read in the fall of 2001, and then the others from 2012, with the exception of 63, which I call the Soccer Dad Canto, which will be the 2001 version. This sounds confusing, but I think you'll easily hear the difference. So here is Charles Alexander reading from Near or Random Acts.
56. Raspberries along the fence outside the house with three levels. Raspberries in the basket held by girl walking barely now. Raspberries on the girl's face. Empty basket tells a tale of the history of raspberries. 57. Once a bicycle, then return. You say go, I stay, and so we go then. 1, 2, 3, 4, and a dog in a car, a cat on a plane. Never such thing as return.
And I'm going to skip to the newest part of this work, which sort of stopped, of course, before the September 11th events, and then started sometimes afterward with this odd poem I'd never sort of thought of myself as writing, which began as every line being an acrostic with its words starting with the letters of the word tower. So, 58. The other world even arises to outwit walls erased rubble that otherwise would easily resist twilight's only willful edged rebuttal. Try our waffles, early riser. Taste our wishes, every reason turns off war's echo restless.
59. It could have come from the east, it could have come from the west, it could have come from the north, it could have come from the south, it had to come on a Tuesday. 60. The year of my birth, the poem of my wish to your birth and beyond. To places planes don't fly into buildings, or people fly into rages. A space only you can build. Can you? 61. Words like crime and war and retaliation and vengeance and justice and military strike against evil and parts of bodies and children without food or parents and collateral damage and don't do it now, please. 62. Native oranges ring around the grandmother's rosebush by pool. Summer's threat to skin's reception frightens the birds into retreat, and we feed them with red and sweet liquid hanging from the limb our savior.
63. On the green field, your leg swings back and ably kicks ball to a teammate. Your mind skips somewhere else as hair flies and time stops to find the day's end for everyone in the world.
64. I'm talking to you through all of this language that won't stay or stand and doesn't mean anything but the act of emergence speaking, a phenomena we can't embrace and equally can't let loose. 65. Whenever you speak, you says the light in the wind or froth in the cup and chair in which sits animal or picture of one, it may be enough to put the world together again. 66. I have not gathered anything like the raspberries in basket that didn't make it indoors but onto face and shirt and laugh. Nothing could break the universe, nothing at all, we keep telling ourselves.
Does someone want to describe the constraint in each of these sections, Mark?
Well, Charles says in one of the intros that I believe he started the poem when he was 35 years old, and the poems are composed of 7 lines with 5 words per line.
Okay, so there's do we get constantly hear the constraint in it, Ron?
No, actually, we don't. It's one of the interesting things. If you close your eyes and listen to this, and I've listened to both the 2012 and 2001 readings this way, sometimes he will read for 2 lines and then pause and then read 1 line and then read a line and a half and then pause and then read the rest of that line or some other variation thereof. It's not consistent, and I certainly know that listening to Louis Zukofsky, who is the origin of this 5-word-per-line format.
In what piece?
Well, Charles credits it to 80 Flowers, but he also used the 5-word-per-lines in A22 and A23, right at the end of his long poem, although they're in a continuous long column of such lines. But Zukofsky broke every second line when you listen to him read, if you listen to the tapes. He's very consistent in that regard. He treats one as though it were caesura and the next one as what we would think of as a spoken line break.
Ken, your thoughts on this question of does the constraint come through in the performance or should it?
Well, should is another matter. I think that what I, you know, completely, I agree with Ron. I think often what I noticed was that it was the two lines, for instance, seems to be the length of his breath. Like this is how long, he's reading as he breathes. And there's one particular poem where he seems to stop in what seems to be a conversational way, right. You know, and how he's speaking to people.
Can we look at 59 and ask the same question? This is the post 9/11. It could have come from the East. It could have. And because he's using a repetition of syntax, but he's got a constraint of five, so things get kind of truncated differently each time. But do we hear that? Are we conscious of it as reading?
I actually think it's more present in 58, because if he's doing the acrostics for tower over and over and over again, what I find is when you do a constraint on a line basis, you really get so focused on the line that the relationships between the lines get sort of, they disappear to a degree.
And
right?
the source text for the acrostic is a five-letter word, so that's going to produce a five-word phrase,
right,
which is naturally going to end stop.
Not, which is much more difficult to sort of
Do we get any enjambment, even though he's using a source word that gives him five words? Each of those lines is different, isn't it?
It is, but if you listen to it as a whole, again, the eye closed test, although I had my eyes open last time I listened to it before today because I was listening to it coming in on the Schuylkill.
And you can't have your eyes closed driving on the Schuylkill Expressway.
It's a bad idea, generally speaking.
Although you probably have the same result. Such a terrible road.
I noticed that Try Our Waffles, Early Riser, sounds so wistful and passionate at the same time, listening to
it. Yes, it does. It's my favorite line. Mark, mm-hmm. Can you say anything about Try Our Waffles?
Well, you know, one of the things I would mention about it is that there is this sort of split between the listening experience of the poem and the viewing experience of the poem. And then if we bring in Charles's history as a bookmaker and a printer, you know, the constraints are very evident when you look at the poem on the page, but you don't hear what you're seeing on the page in quite the same way when you read the poem. So there is a sort of a split, I think, between the visual experience and the oral experience.
Yeah. Can I ask you a semi-related question? Why at the in a break in a series when there's been a trauma, in this case a sort of international trauma rather than a family trauma, although he's dealing at the level of family material, so there's both, but why go to a double constraint? Because he's already got one. Why add the... Why did he do that? Is there some kind of general thought you have about that?
You know, I just think that, you know, we as poets do what we need in the moment. And, you know, something around that incident must have made him feel as if, you know, yet another level of constraint was the way to go with this particular section.
Ken, your thought on that?
I think that the use of constraint in general, or the way I thought about it, was as a way to sort of negotiate speaking to a 7-year-old, basically, and who was going to be a 15-year-old and the 35-year-old and the 45-year-old,
right,
who might have reference to that text. And how do you do that properly, producing good poems? And then so the constraints provide a mechanism in which to do that, and this is particularly difficult. So
in part, it's I don't want to say didactic, but he's saying something to Nora about the way we live, or about the way one might live.
He's also making an allusion. I mean, the use of the acrostic is as he does for different people in other places. You can hear Creeley, you can hear some other people deliberately quoted throughout the sections of the first half of this book. But here it seems quite clearly an allusion to the work of Jackson McClough, who used exactly this kind of acrostic to create works and who lived about four blocks from the World Trade Center at 42 North Moore Street. Mm.
And who, as an anarcho-pacifist, must have had something to say about this situation. I actually don't know specifically what he had to say, but one can easily imagine it. So we've commented on Try Our Waffles Early Riser, which, you know, as the dad of a daughter, I know what early riser means in that context, and the fact that it could come out of Tower. Well, I don't know. Should we say the obvious? Ken, do you mind saying the obvious about that? I mean, you have this word Tower, and you run it across the line, and you're feeding waffles to your early rising daughter.
I think your choice of the 11 poems, I mean, is this sort of parenthetical. It closes itself off, and that there's a number of ways in which this work of 70 poems is a like closings, you know, like openings and closings. And so there's a sense of the boundaries between the domestic and, for lack of a better term, public, you know, the world outside. And I think that this poem particularly sort of injects this sort of intimacy and sort of joy of being, you know, with his daughter into this horrible event, basically.
Yeah. Do you see this as foretelling the reference to raspberries a couple of sections later? I mean, I think of this sequence as the raspberry suite. It starts with raspberries.
Right.
It ends with raspberries. Yeah. And there are no other poems among the 70 poems that actually use the word raspberry. Yeah.
So can you do a quick reading of 66? I have not gathered anything like the raspberries.
In basket, and there the word.
There's no article there.
There is no article there in order to keep it within the five words constraint.
Yes.
But I also think, again, an allusion in this case to the dog of Gertrude Stein, whose
Say
name
more.
Was Basket. And Gertrude Stein's life in the south of France during the Second World War is what gets called up for me in that phrase.
That's cool.
Unstein-Stein, right? In the second half, yeah.
So we get raspberries in 66, and all I can think of is in 56, which is the pre-9/11. You know, it's quote-unquote innocent. It's an innocent canto or innocent section of 9/11, and now there's no such thing as that by 66.
Oh, I think 56, if it's pre-9/11, it's sort of horrifically sort of foretelling, because yeah. There's this sense of it also being an image of a child or a victim, basically.
Yes. Right. It's like the Lyndon Johnson anti-Goldwater, the child, you
picking
know, with that
the,
kind
picking
of
the daisies.
Picking a daisy with the dramatic irony behind her.
56. Raspberries along the fence outside the house with three levels. Raspberries in the basket held by girl walking barely now. Raspberries on the girl's face. Empty basket tells a tale of the history of raspberries. 57. Once a bicycle, then return. You say go, I stay, and so we go then. 1, 2, 3, 4, and a dog in a car, a cat on a plane. Never such thing as return.
And so we go then, 1, 2, 3, 4, and a dog in a car. So there's something kid-lit about it. There's something testing, clearing his throat through the constraint. It's fun. It's gay. A cat that is gleeful. A cat on a plane. A cat on a plane. A cat on a hat. And suddenly plane isn't going to work so innocently anymore. Mark, your thought on this?
Right. And that section even ends, never such thing as return. It's almost a sense that you can't go back to that innocent moment, and then you have the tower piece right after that.
I think we chose to listen to the 2012 version of section 60, and I thought, you know, in a kind of stupid, superficial host of a radio show, I would get the power of that post 9/11 moment, but it's post. It's 2012.
60. The year of my birth, the poem of my wish to your birth and beyond. To places planes don't fly into buildings or people fly into rages. A space only you can build. Can you?
So it's not just that Nora has now grown and is living rather than dead, that Nora is an adult, and that we all, you know, any parent who remembers the child in that vulnerable moment, so interestingly that it would become deeper. Can we indulge me some more and look at the Soccer Dad canto, which is 63. On the green field, your leg swings back and ably kicks, etc., etc. There's a reference. There's a post 9/11 reference there, I think. Does anybody see it besides me? The President of the United States, George Bush, told us pretty immediately that we should go out and we should go play sports and we should go to attend baseball games and shop at the mall. And there's a way in which the previously scheduled, how old is she at this point, 7 or 8, the 8-year-old soccer girls are out there doing their thing, and here's the dad watching, and he, I don't know. Mark, am I going nowhere with that?
No, I think that, you know, I mean, one of the great things about the poem is that it is this piece about fatherhood that's mixed with what's happening in the world. And we see it in this piece. We see it in the numerous references, I think, to children's literature. In like 65, it ends, it may be enough to put the world together again.
Humpty Dumpty.
Humpty Dumpty. We see that the father-daughter relationship throughout the piece, whatever's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm. Ken, can I ask you about 64? I'm talking to you through all of this language. Do we have an implied theory of language there? If we had to base our understanding of what Charles Alexander thought about language from only section 64, what would we have to say?
I think my sense of this in both of these poems were the two that I sort of struggled with the most with, I felt as if 64 particularly was about the sort of complication of using language to in existence with anybody, right? I mean, particularly somebody who you're responsible for and you feel really intimate with. But at the same time, there is a sense that the word talk is a kind of hope, meaning that your body, your behavior, your speaking, the prosody, whatever, is a means of communicating that is effective. Basically, I don't know what else to do.
Despite the non-transparency of language,
right?
The language won't stand, it won't stay, but it doesn't mean anything. But I'm still, there's an act of emergence in speaking to you anyway. Mark, what? Pertaining to the sections that we're discussing for this episode of Poem Talk, what would you say the title of the work, Near or Random Acts, means?
I'm not sure about the title, but one, you know, the use of the word near makes me think that, you know, one of the struggles in the poem is between kind of space and time. You see it in the poem that goes, it could have been east, could have been west, but it had to come on a Tuesday.
Right.
In 63, which we were just talking about, there's all this action happening in a space of the soccer field, but then time stops. In the next piece, it's, you know, I'm talking to you all this language that won't stay or stand. And so in all of these, there's a sense of this sort of space-time pull against each other. So I think that's part of that near or random acts.
You know, we could talk about these sections and the other sections for a long time, but I'd like to invite each of us to say one more thing that you meant to say when you were thinking about this on the way up from Washington, D.C., or on the Schuylkill Expressway, to add to the conversation. So, Ron, do you have a final thought on this?
Yes, I do. I've known Charles for over 30 years, and I have a tendency to read each of his major books as though it were his masterpiece. And in a way, each one is. And they really are, even though they have family resemblances, very different projects. If I look at this compared with Hopeful Buildings or Pushing Water, they're all, you know, these very dramatic, complete projects in and of themselves. He has a relationship towards the idea of writing as a project that I find quite unique, and it's something I try to learn from.
Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you. Ken, last thought?
I actually was struck more by the use of the word random, and I appreciated you mentioning Jackson McLeod, because the section, in the second section where there's the prayer poems with the parenthetical spaces, and then there's the blocks, and it's the 5x5 blocks. It's a strange thought, but all I could think of was sort of the drupelets of a raspberry, right? And so it brought me back, continually back to that. And so this sort of graphical representation on the page differing, like we talked about earlier, so much from what the readings were like. In fact, I saw the 2001 readings as really very, very anxious, and then the second half of the book being sort of opening up and being sort of very sort of disclosing. So
great. Thank you, Ken. Mark?
Well, I was, you know, interested in seeing it as a, you know, yet another perspective on the 9/11 poem. You know, it's I think about, you know, work like Juliana Spahr's work, like Kamau Brathwaite has this great piece in the Born to Slow Horses book. In spoken word to someone like Emmanuel Ortiz's A Moment of Silence that goes through Chile and 9/11. And this is this very kind of intimate, paternal, father-daughter piece on 9/11. And I think it's just it's a different perspective that I haven't quite seen on 9/11 poem.
I agree with you. And I think one of the reasons it's different is that the project was constrained and well underway when 9/11 hit, so that the dramatic irony we see in the precursor sections, you know, were with a project that was already established. And so there's a certain continuous present that's here. I guess my final word has to do with the beginning of section 64. I'm talking to you through all of this language. Of course, he's talking to us as readers and listeners of the performances, but the you would be in the project. It would be Nora, a 7-year-old girl. So I like the idea that we're in the subject position of a 7-year-old daughter, and I think that clears the head a bit, and it allows the poet to be parental to us but with love rather than condescension. And I really like being in that position with respect to 9/11. So, anyway, thank you for those final words. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, which is a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. And, Mark, you look prepared to gather some paradise.
Well, one of the things that, you know, right before this recording, I went over to see the Jeremy Deller show.
Oh, it's fantastic.
And
Institute of Contemporary Art.
It is fabulous. And so one of the books that I've been reading that he's actually included in is called Living as Form, Socially Engaged Art by Nato Thompson. Came out about a year or so ago from MIT Press. Fabulous, fabulous book.
Can you say really quickly what you yourself are working on at the moment?
I'm working on a series of transnational poetry dialogues with domestic workers in the U.S. and London.
Thank you. Great. Ron Silliman, Gather Some Paradise.
Okay.
Can I say you are paradise?
Oh.
It's just great to see you. Didn't you write a book called Paradise?
I did. Yeah. I did, indeed. Okay. And people have made lots of assumptions about that.
For instance, what?
Rob Wilson has a wonderful piece on the theology of my work, for example.
Is he right?
What do you think, Al? I'm not going to answer that question, other than to note that the very last sentence of that book is the warning Sergeant Esther House gave the teams in Hill Street Blues.
Do it to them
day.
Before they...
No.
Hey, be careful out there. Hill Street
right.
Blues.
Right, exactly. The paradise I would bring today is a writer whose work I have been loving all year. Her name is Chus Pato. She is a Galician poet from the northwest of Spain who writes in Galician. She's a Galician nationalist and separatist. She's a teacher at the community college level in Lalín. Her works are translated into English by Aaron Moore, and most of them are available. There are four books available in English, three of them from Shearsman, the wonderful British press out of Exeter, www.shearsman.com. And the fourth one, Succession, which I'm reading right now, is from Aaron Moore's own press in Canada called Zatso Publications. Zat is spelled Z-A-T. Zatso
Say
Publications.
Say the name of the poet again and spell it.
Chus, C-H-U-S, Pato, P-A-T-O. It means strong duck.
Strong duck. That's fantastic. Thank you all. Well, that's all the waffles for early risers we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Ken Jacobs, Mark Nowak, Ron Silliman, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, Chris Martin, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, I'm joined by Juliet Lee, Jessica Lowenthal, and Leanne Brown to talk about Lainey Brown's Daily Sonnets. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us for that or another Poem Talk.